We're standing here in what's called the Churva Square, okay? And again, just to orient you, all right? So that's east, right? Old City, Kotel, Temple Mount, Jordan. And that's west, western part of the city. That's the way out of the Old City, Jaffa Gate, whatever. You look around you, this is the largest wide open space in the Old City of Jerusalem, okay? And it's the center of the Jewish Quarter. There are today approximately 6,000 Jews who live in the Old City of Jerusalem. There are about 60 to 65,000 Arabs. Actually, as of this morning, there's 65,003. But anyway, but it's about 10% Jewish today in the Jewish Quarter. 6,000 Jews, about 65,000 Arabs in the Old City. There are actually four quarters, but we're going to talk about that on Shabbat. There is the Armenian Quarter, the Arab Christian Quarter, the Muslim Quarter, and the Jewish Quarter. There used to be a fifth quarter down by the Kotel called the Maghrib Quarter. Only the Jews could come up with a five-quarter system. But that quarter was an illegal housing area, and Moshe Dayan cleared it away in the after the Six-Day War because they built up against the Kotel and whatever. Anyway, you kind of wonder, like, you're in the oldest, one of the oldest cities in the world. It's not the oldest, but it's one of the oldest cities in the world. In fact, I'm waiting for peace because when real peace comes, I'll get to visit Damascus. And Damascus probably is the oldest city, at least in the Mideast, Western, Judeo-Christian, Arab world, right? And it's interesting. And how do you get such a wide open space? I mean, for 3,000 years, nobody built anything here? So the truth is that in a minute when we're sitting here, I'll tell you a little more. But after 48, when we came back here, so the Jewish Quarter was completely destroyed. Look around you, and you will see that all the buildings here are new. There's very little old. These are all new buildings. Why? Because everything that was here, buildings that were hundreds and sometimes thousands of years old, were reduced to rubble. So since they had this wide open area, they decided, instead of rebuilding everything, let's create an open space in the Jewish Quarter, because we don't want this to be a museum, we want it to be a place where people can live, right?
When was it destroyed to the rubble?
Between 1948 and 1967.
Oh, just in that 20 years.
Right. Yeah. In fact, when we came back here, I have a friend, I'll tell you an interesting story. I have a friend who, well, you know what, remind me, and I'll tell you when we're sitting down, okay? Anyway, so they decided to leave this area open, and they were building this up. And while they were building this up, they found something very interesting, which is this, okay? Now, this was actually not quite like this. You see these stones, they're on the floor here, on the northern part of the Churva Square, next to this cafe, and it looks like they just ran out of money and didn't get to finish the plaza. You know, like every week you see some Nebuchadnezzar tripping over these stones, right? So I got curious, what are these stones? So it's a very interesting story. There was a king by the name of Agrippas, okay? King Agrippas lived at the end of the period of the Second Temple, when Judea, which is the state that was existing in this area, Eretz Yehuda, right, was basically a vassal state of Rome, okay? And Agrippas was basically a puppet. He was appointed. He wasn't, he has a very Greek-sounding name, right? So he had a problem that all politicians have. Unemployment. Unemployment is not good. You don't want too much unemployment. People have too much time on their hands. They start to get busy with things you don't want them to get busy with, like rebellion, whatever. So he decides to create a public works program, right? And he decides to refortify the walls of ancient Jerusalem. Great idea. So he puts people to work, and they're quarrying the stone, and it's terrific, and pride. And the Romans get wind of the fact that King Agrippas is refortifying the ancient walls of Jerusalem. They do not like this. They don't want him refortifying the walls for obvious reasons. 100 years later, the decision that Rome made proves to be very prescient because right, they were the ones who needed to break in. So they send a letter to King Agrippas, and it basically says something like, I don't know, Dear Grip, we'd really like you to stop fortifying your walls or we'll have to come and crush you. Right? So Agrippas gets the message, but he's got all these stones quarried. He doesn't know what to do. So he comes up with a great idea, Plan B, right? Because he's got this elite group that are the aristocracy, the priests, the kohanim, the teachers of the Jewish people, he'll build them a sidewalk. So, that's exactly what he does. He builds them a special sidewalk, which leads directly to the Temple Mount. Now, by the way, this was actually about a meter down. It was lower. But they'd already built this whole square. They didn't want to rip up the square. So they actually raised these stones so that you could see them. They were really a little lower. But this sidewalk basically went all the way up to Har Habayit, to the Temple Mount. So if you're a kohen, and you were, you know, ritually pure, and you needed to get to the Temple Mount, had your own sidewalk to walk on. This was great. Scored big points with the Kohanim. You know, they had an annual We Love Grip Day. It was great, right? What amazes me about this, right, is that when you talk about, you know, you're here, we're going to be out in the mountains of Gush Etzion, and I'll show you where Avram lived and where they walked. And it's just like general, in these mountains Abraham walked. But in this place, I can tell you that the Kohanim, who lived at the end of the period of the Second Temple, right, the priests, they walked here. Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol, the high priest, who speaks to heaven, who's quoted in the Talmud, who's one of the holiest men in Jewish history, he stood on this stone. He had to. He walked here every day. This whole area was the neighborhood of the Kohanim. In fact, underneath the Yeshivat HaKotel, we don't have time to go there either, but I highly recommend you go. When they built the Yeshivat HaKotel, which is the big building, pardon?
Go where?
When they built Yeshivat HaKotel, right, which is the largest building in the Old City, it's right next to us, it's behind these trees here. In fact, you see that sign over there, the Wall Archaeological Museum? It's right there. You walk up past where that car is over there, right, which is on the eastern side of the Churva Plaza, and you get right to it. There's a door there, you can go in there. They were building this huge building, they dug down to build a foundation, they found all these homes. So they know what to do. They couldn't build the building because you can't destroy an archaeological site. Right? Nobody's interested in funding. Do you mind if we destroy 2,000 years of history to build our yeshiva? Right? But they had the land, they had everything set up. So they actually raised more money and they built the building in a very ingenious way around these homes. They widened the foundation. It's an amazing story, but for another time. And so you can visit underneath the yeshiva and visit a museum of the homes of Kohanim who lived and taught and served on the Temple Mount. And I can't even begin to tell you. I'm not going to take you there because you don't need me to take you. Go in there and see it. Amazing. Okay? So I once took, yeah, this whole area was the homes of Kohanim. I went underneath where we're standing, absolutely there were Kohanim's homes. But if we dig everything up, we'll have to destroy everything, and that's a... Pardon? There are a few Levites in the corner over there, the Goldberg... No, right? Yeah, sure, absolutely, right?
Do you think the stones were chipped away or they were smoother and maybe...
No, they were for sure smoother. You know?
Weathered over time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, unless Agrippus really hated the Kohanim and he was trying to... But, you know, so I once took a group of Israelite students. We were studying the Mishnah of Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol before Yom Kippur, which is an amazing Mishnah. And we came down and we sat on these stones and I studied the Mishnah with them. And then at the end, I said to them, by the way, this fellow that we've just been studying, this is where he walked, like right here. You know, there's certain places you just have to feel the ground. So I urge you, don't do what all the tourists do, which is to walk around this. Walk over this sidewalk and you'll be stepping on your own past. Come. All right? Oh, can't resist. Okay, this is Benny Friedman's little piece of trivia, all right? Now, you who are of the Queen's country know exactly what this is, but for the rest of you rebels, does anybody know what this is?
It's a postbox. It is a postbox.
It's just a postbox, that's absolutely correct. A mailbox, right? This is where they delivered the posts, the mail, the packages. However, there's something very interesting about this mailbox. Come over here and feel this mailbox. I'm not asking you to do something weird. Just
check out the mail on that.
Feel the mailbox.
Do you feel how heavy that is?
Yes.
This is cast iron. This is 2 tons. Don't you think that's a little bit excessive for a mailbox? So I'll tell you the story of this mailbox, which I discovered when I was trying to mail a cassette to someone in the days before modern technology. If you look at the entrance to the mailbox here, all right, you will see that you can't fit anything in there but a letter. And that's because this is a British Mandate period mailbox. The British invented this because they were struggling with two different groups that were trying to uproot them and kick them out of the country, right? In the fight for independence, the Arabs and certain groups of Jews. And one of the things, unfortunately, one of the vehicles that was being used at the time, mostly by Arab terrorist groups, was letter bombs. So on the one hand, I'm tremendously saddened that we still need these kinds of mailboxes. On the other hand, I love the fact that the Israeli army sends its mail in a British mandate postbox. I love that. Come.
There's something missing here.
There's something missing?
Yes.
What's missing?
Here, there should be the coat of arms.
Ah, I think probably the Irgun probably took that off. Okay, so let me give you a little background. Okay, and then I'll tell you why we're sitting in this place. I love coming in here because this is a place where the tour groups just all walk by. It's actually heartbreaking. There's so many places in the Old City that people just walk by because they're looking for the big sites. Got to get to the Kotel, got to get to the Cardo, you know, so they miss all these places, which is sad. However, having said that, in 1917, and the British came to this part of the world, and we'll talk about this a little more on Shabbat, we're going to tour on Shabbat afternoon. When the British came to this part of the world, they found a mess. The British had promised a home to the Arabs. They'd also promised a home to the Jews, right? Famous declaration of Lord Balfour in 1913. And, pardon? No, 1917 was when Allenby conquered, if I'm not mistaken, although it will not be the first time I get the numbers wrong. Allenby came into the Jaffa Gate. The British took this over from the Turks in 1917. I think Lord Balfour was 1913, but I could be wrong. Now we'll have something to do homework on. We'll check it out. Was it 17? So what was 19? Oh, 1913 was the emperor, what's his name? Franz Josef? Not Franz Josef. Yeah, Franz Josef. Pardon? Wilhelm. Wilhelm. There you go. It comes into the German game. Anyway, thank you. Anyway, so when the British came here, 1917, they found a mess. And so they were given a mandate by then the League of Nations to try to clean it up. It took them 30 years to realize they couldn't make a clean breast of it. It wasn't working. So they handed it back to the United Nations. The United Nations decided to create a fact-finding mission, which they did in 1947, that came to the conclusion that this area should be two states. It should be a state for the Arabs and a state for the Jews. During the course of this whole experiment in the 1920s, the British actually took approximately 60% or 65% of the area that was supposed to be part of the mandate, right? And they gave it to the Arabs. They created the country of Transjordan. Transjordan, 72%. I thought 72% includes the southern, well, whatever, okay, fine, 72%. We'll get there anyway. Right, so they gave them, they created the country of Transjordan, which hadn't existed before. That's a whole political discussion, but in a nutshell, Chaim Weizmann and his buddies debated what they should do about this, because they'd basically given half of the land that was under, you know, sort of being contested as a homeland for the Jewish people to the Arabs. And the reason that they decided not to vehemently protest this was because they figured, all right, now there'll be an Arab state, so now they'll give us the other side of the Jordan River as a Jewish state, which is where most of the Jews live anyway, right? Interestingly enough, in Weizmann's notes, you find that since that side of the Jordan River was considered more fertile at the time, right? So they figured that the Arabs would be much happier with that side of the Jordan River, which is interesting when you look at how history has developed. 70% of Jordan's agriculture is actually in that Jordan Valley. We're going to see this when we go up to the Golan on Wednesday. In any event, the United Nations took a vote in 1947 on November 29th, a famous vote, and they voted to partition this into two states. The Jews accepted this, albeit with a heavy heart, because it did not include major areas of Jewish settlement, including Gush Etzion, which we're going to visit on Tuesday, right? And including the Old City of Jerusalem. Yerushalayim, the heart of the Jewish people, was going to be an international city monitored actually by the Catholic Church, right? At least according to one proposal. The Jews accepted it, the Arabs did not. The British announced that since this was the decision of the United Nations, they took their opportunity to get out. This was their Vietnam, as it were, at the time. So they announced that on May 14th they would be leaving, ending the period of British rule here. The Jews announced that on the day that the British left, they would declare a sovereign state of Israel. And the Arabs announced that on the day that the British left and the Jews declared their state of Israel, that they would invade. And this would be the shortest-lived state in the history of the world. There were seven Arab armies poised to invade Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, you know, Saudi Arabia, with all sorts of additions. You're more than welcome to join us. All sorts of additions from all over the Arab world, from 22 Arab countries, right? The reason, by the way, that they could not attack until after the British left was because if they would attack across the border before the British left, they would be invading British sovereign territory, which would effectively be declaring war on Britain, something they didn't want to do. However, the Arabs that were living inside Israel had no such problem. Okay? The Jordanian Legion, which was absolutely the best trained fighting force in the Middle East, including the Jews, right, from a military perspective, they were British trained, they were mostly French armed, they were meant to be patterned after the French Foreign Legion. They are the only Arab force that we consistently lost to in 1948. That's why we lost Beit Lechem, Hebron, the entire area that came later to be known as the West Bank. It's interesting, it only became known as the West Bank when we took it back, but that's another discussion, right? The old city of Jerusalem. They were led by a man named Pasha Glob, who was a British officer, and they were led by a fellow by the name of Abdullah Tell, who was an Arab, who was also a brilliant tactician. And they set their sights on the old city of Jerusalem, the heart of the Jewish people. Okay? At the time, there were 1,400 Israelis, Jews, living in the old city of Jerusalem, and 200 Israeli fighters. 200 fighters were protecting 1,400 civilians, men, women, the old, the young, etc. They were surrounded by 3,200 legionnaires. Okay? A full legion division. 3,200 legionnaires fighting 200 fighters. In addition to the 3,200 legionnaires, there were 30,000 Arab irregulars. Now, what's an Arab irregular? You go into a local Arab village, you say, I don't know, Yalla Akhban al-Yahud, let's go get some Jews. Everybody with a hunting rifle comes out, and before you know it, you have an army of 30,000 men. Now, fighting against a rabble, right, a mob, there are certain things you can do when you fight a mob. We learned this in Lebanon, that you can't do against a trained army. Losing to a mob is a very frightening proposition. So, you got to think about these numbers for a second. Let this sink in. 200 Israeli fighters, Palmachniki mostly, of the early vestiges of the IDF, are fighting 33,000 men. That's nuts. It was a six-month siege with 6 weeks of intensive fighting. They held off 33,000 men for 6 weeks. Now, I tell you all this here because this was one of the most important positions in the old city. Okay, you just look down that street, right? We're opposite the Cardo. And down that street, you can basically see the Arab marketplace. That was the edge of the Jewish quarter. You know, we have this image of the Jews in the old city walls firing from behind the old city walls. That's not the way it was. It was neighborhood to neighborhood. You know, on Shabbat, when we walk around, and later as you walk around, you'll see that, you know, it's very easy to wander from one quarter into another, no walls. So this was a very difficult place to defend. This is the widest avenue from the Muslim, the Arab quarter, into the Jewish quarter. And therefore, they attacked along this route in battalion strength every day. Now, the Jews had 3 heavy machine guns. They didn't have much in the way of arms. They had only 3 heavy machine guns. One of them was positioned in this spot. It didn't look exactly like it did now with such nice marble steps and everything. It was like, you know, a dirt room. And they had sandbags piled up over there where those steps are. And this was a critical position. Because if this fell, and the Hurva fell, which is the huge building behind us that was a synagogue, right? So then the Arabs had a foothold in the Jewish quarter, and that would be the beginning of the end. So the 3 men who manned this machine gun position were forbidden to leave this position until they were relieved. They couldn't leave here not to go to the bathroom, not to get their food. Their lunch was brought to them every day by a runner. Anyway, one day these 3 men are sitting in this position. This is a story that I heard. And lunch doesn't come. 1 o'clock, 1:30, 2 o'clock, 2:30, 3 o'clock. They start to get nervous. And this was not a static battle. This was a very dynamic, you know, situation. Things could change from day to day. What if the Jordanians had surrounded them or were behind them? They didn't know what to do. So finally, late in the afternoon, one of these 3 fellows decides, all right, you know what, we're going to go out and check. So he steps out of this position, and he walks around the area behind, and he comes across the youngest Israeli soldier ever to be killed in active duty in combat. His name was Nissim Gini, and he was 11 years old. He was a runner between the positions. And he was hit by sniper fire, not 30 feet from here. The thing that they can't figure out is that he was hit in the stomach. The stomach wound happens to be the most painful type of wound. Once in my life, I saw a person hit by shrapnel from a stomach wound. It's an extremely painful and horrible and a slow way to die. And you can't not scream out in pain when you have a stomach wound. So they couldn't figure out why he didn't call out to them to alert them. They thought they should have heard him. And the theory, which of course we'll never know, is that this boy realized that if he called out to his comrades in arms to come out and help him, they would come under fire from the same sniper. Sniper fire is a totally surreal type of combat. So he died and gave up his life in order to protect these 3 men, which in and of itself is an incredible story, but doesn't end there. Because after 1967, right, eventually the Jewish quarter fell, and we'll get to that story, if not today, on Shabbat. Eventually the Jewish quarter fell, and the Jewish quarter was basically bereft of Jews until 1967. In 1967, we came home, and we found a Jewish quarter destroyed. Synagogues, Jewish holy places, homes, completely destroyed. The Hurva Synagogue was completely gutted. It's right behind us. They used it as a stables. They found so much manure in there, it took them 4 months to clean it out, bucket by bucket. They found Torah scrolls left in the bottom of the manure. And the Jewish people, to their credit, wanted only one thing. There was no victory parade. There was no looting. They just wanted to rebuild, which is all we've ever been about. So they started rebuilding the old city. And in the process of rebuilding the old city, they decided they wanted to make a memorial to the Jews who fell during that time. Naturally, they decided to make the memorial here. So they decided to dig this out and, you know, make it nice. And while they're doing this, they came across this. This is a Crusader arch. It's actually the largest Crusader arch of its type in the entire Middle East that we know of. Huge in terms of its depth. You'll see, you know, when we're up north that this is very large, right? And so they got excited. They started digging through here. And they saw the size of this arch. And the theory is that there was a very large Crusader period church that once sat on top of this structure. The reason it's no longer here is because the Muslims destroyed, when Salah ad-Din came and conquered the city, they destroyed all of the Christian holy sites, just like the Jewish ones. And the theory is that there was a very large church here. So they dug out this Crusader arch, and when they finished digging out the Crusader arch, they found this. This is a mikveh. This is a mikveh, a Jewish ritual bath, that dates back to the period of the Second Temple period. Okay? This is over 2,000 years old. In fact, I can tell you exactly when this mikveh was built. Because you see, this mikveh makes a lot of sense because it's located right next to the sidewalk that Agrippa's built that I showed you before. Which makes a lot of sense. Because they would come to this mikveh, and there are a couple of other ones that they've discovered, and they would immerse themselves, they'd be able to get right up on the sidewalk, they'd be ritually pure, they wouldn't bump into anybody because nobody else used the sidewalk, and they could go straight up on the Temple Mount. Makes a lot of sense. Now think about this. What is a mikveh? A mikveh is a place where you go to purify yourself if you're impure. Tameh. What does that mean, to be impure? Right? You ever wonder about that? Like a woman, you know, when she has her menstrual cycle, it's called tameh. She's impure. You know, and a man, by the way, also, when a man has a seminal emission, so he also becomes impure. Today it's a little different because we don't have a temple. But back then it was the same implication. You couldn't go up on the Temple Mount. So you had to, depending on the circumstance, ultimately wait 7 days. And then at the end, you immersed yourself in a mikveh, and then presto chango, you go up in the Temple Mount. So what is that? Like, woo, get yourself clean? So what is tum'ah? What is this impurity? So it's really very simple. You know, there are two parts to who we are in this world. There is the physical part, you know. At the end of the day, on one level, right? There's a physical level, right? Which is that at the end of the day, we're animals. We need to eat. We need to sleep. You know, we have desires, right? We're physical beings. And as physical beings, we're very limited. And of course, if you're a physical being, you know, eventually, you know, it's over and what's the point? But there's a part of us that goes way beyond the physical. We're also spiritual beings. And that speaks to all those parts of us that have no limits. Because physical things are by definition limited. That's why Maimonides suggests God could never be physical. Because if God was physical, he'd be here and not there. And God is everywhere. Why would you worship something that's physical? So Judaism suggests, therefore, that we live with this tension between the spiritual part of us, all those things that have the capacity for endlessness, the ability to love, the ability to give. You know, I remember when our second child was born, I remember sitting up one night with my wife and we were thinking about this. Because our first child, our daughter, was born. What an amazing gift. And as much as you ever thought you could love in this world, you have a child. It's like, whoa, it's just endless. And now you have a second child. How am I going to love the second child? I mean, I love the first child. Where am I going to make room for the second child? And I look back at this ridiculous conversation, but I've met so many young couples who have the same conversation. Because you just don't imagine that you could have more love. But love is endless. You know, giving is endless. Right? So at the end of the day, if we're created, and if we're put here for a reason, and if that reason is part of what we have to give to the world, so we have this enormous opportunity to tap into this endlessness within us, of course, which comes from God, the endless one, whatever it might be, right? The ultimate reminder that at the end of the day, I'm also a physical being, and that it all ends, and if so, what's the purpose? I'm here today, I'm gone tomorrow, might as well just have a good time, is death. So Judaism says when you come into contact with death, you need to give that a pause. You need to respect that that's an experience you have to think about. So whenever Judaism experiences a contact with death, it stops for a moment. You know, Jews don't bury a loved one and go back to work the next day. You sit shiva for 7 days. You've got to think about that. You have to immerse yourself in experience. And the same is true with nida, right? What does it mean that a woman had a menstrual cycle or a man had a seminal emission? It means the potential for life was lost. That's a form of death. So you stop, and you appreciate that. That's an enormous thing, that the potential for life was lost. Even though it might be a good thing, maybe the woman isn't married yet. But it's still an enormous thing. So a woman goes through a process. And in the family, in the home, things slow down and stop without going into details. And the end of that process is that the woman immerses herself in a mikvah. Or a man immerses himself in a mikvah. And what is a mikvah? Water, which must come from live flowing water from a spring or from the rain. Water represents blessing, bracha, right? Water represents life. So the ultimate end to our contact with death is the decision to immerse ourselves in life. So 50, 60 years ago, on this very spot, Jews were willing to give up their lives. They were willing to experience that contact with death for something that they thought was greater than life itself, and they were doing it in the exact same spot where 2,000 years earlier, Jews were immersing themselves in life as a result of their contact with death. And that is Judaism in a nutshell. A circle. And what they did, we're going to go out, but what they did is they put the names of all those who fell in the old city inside the mikvah. You can see there's a list here on the wall, tells you their names, where they fell, and what age they were. In 1948, in the siege of 1948. This map, by the way, I wouldn't pay too much attention to it because it's actually backwards and upside down. We just came from, if you look over here, when you walk outside, you'll see the minaret of this mosque, which is a story in and of itself that's really over here. And this is the Tiferet Yisrael Synagogue, which is really over here, right? And so on and so forth. This is the Bate Machsa Square, which is really that way. So it got so confusing trying to explain this to groups. But this was put here because there's a list of the major events that occurred in this battle, and they light up at a certain point, and you're supposed to be able to see sort of, you know, what's happening in the battle and how it's going. And it's interesting to come and explore on your own sometime. Right? Like this was the breach into the Mount Zion, into Shaar Zion, which is really that way. But, okay.
What happened to the 1,300 Jews in 1948?
We're going to get to that too in a few minutes. Good question. He ends up dying at the other end of that alleyway. And the fellow who's talking to me was one of the four men in the alley next door. Looks at me and says, I want you to know, if not for this fellow, I wouldn't be here. So if you're going to walk down this street and stand in this place, you have to tell this story. Now I want you to understand, there's certain places in this world where you have to feel the earth beneath your feet. You know? You can't just walk down an alleyway. And the truth is, we're going to walk down this alleyway because I want to show you something, but ever since I've heard that story, you can't just walk down this alleyway. You know? We are blessed. We live in an era where we can get on a plane, come to the state of Israel, and walk around in a Jewish state, protected by Jewish soldiers, speaking Jewish words of a Hebrew language. And we're able to do this because 30, 40, 50, and 60 years ago, men like that were willing to give up everything so that we could walk here free. And that's something to think about. Come follow me. So this is that street that I was just telling you about. And the reason I stood you over there was because you can't really get a sense of the fact that you're coming out to an open area when you're standing over here. But this is actually, you can see that this is all new, and now you're going to walk down a street that's somewhat old, and that's why they didn't realize that it was here, I think, or maybe the other rubble alley they didn't realize was here, as I understand it. So this is what I'm talking about. Come, and you'll see why you walk down, how it's windy, why he couldn't just call out to the guys at the other end of this alleyway. So, just briefly, during the siege in 1948, there's pieces of this that we can't even begin to relate to. Like, this is not a war zone like Iraq, where you're up there on the border, you're an American soldier, you're fighting a war. Or like I had when we were in Lebanon. This is like a neighborhood. I mean, there are people who live here. You live here with your family. They went through all sorts of very, very difficult experiences because, you know, on the one hand, if you leave the old city of Jerusalem with your family because it's dangerous, you're making a statement, you're giving up. On the other hand, how do you bring up your children in a war zone? Very difficult. There's actually a magnificent book. It's called Forever My Jerusalem. I think it's written by Pua Steiner, who grew up here as a child, and she writes of her experiences. She actually came back after the Six-Day War and moved back into the house that she had lived in as a child and lives here still, and you can meet her, and it's an incredible book. It's written so that adults can get a lot out of it, but children can read it as well. I highly recommend it. It's called Forever My Jerusalem by Pua Steiner. I do not get a cut, right? One of the more difficult chapters was that during these 6 months and really the 6 weeks of intensive siege, people were killed. There were 63, 68, you can read it on the sign on the wall, some odd Jews that were killed during this period. Problem is, traditionally, Jews don't bury their dead inside the old city walls. For reasons of ritual purity, with the exception of kings and, you know, righteous kings and prophets, we don't bury the dead here. Because they, you know, cause just what we spoke about before, death, impurity, the old city of Jerusalem, Kohanim, priests. But the Jordanian Legion would not let the Jews take their dead out for burial. They refused to negotiate this with the Red Cross, the Jordanians. So they were forced to find a way to bury their dead here. So the only place they could find that they thought was reasonably safe from sniper fire was this courtyard. So this was actually the place where they buried their dead. There were about 63 or 68. Again, you can look at the sign on the wall, right? In this spot were buried those 67, 68 Jews. In fact, when we came back here in 67, there was still a painted sign on this wall, which I personally think they should have left here, right? Po Nitmanu, here were interred the Jewish fighters of the old city of Jerusalem, right? And when we came back in 1967, so they did what's called Likut HaTzamot, they reinterred the bodies up on the Mount of Olives, but the halacha is that you always leave a marker, because what if you miss something, etc.? So Kohanim actually traditionally, even though halachically you're allowed to walk into an area where it was done, because there's an assessment that it was done, that's why they put this little fence here, you know, they walk around. You gotta think about what that means. I mean, 6 weeks of siege, 42 days, almost 70 people dead. That means that basically every afternoon, a different family came to this courtyard and said goodbye. And parents losing children, husbands leaving wives, saying goodbye to parents, all that in this spot. And I wonder sometimes, did they sense, did they know, even when they were forced out of here, that one day we'd come home? Right? Another interesting thing about this courtyard, by the way, is that if you look over there, there's a sign on the wall. By the way, one of the things you can do, see these brown signs on the wall? So before you go out and you buy like a bike, you know, not a bike, you buy a book, Freudian, you buy a book, right? You know, a tour guide book, whatever. You can actually take a tour of the Jewish Quarter of Jerusalem just by reading these signs. Magnificent, right? So this was a yeshiva, it was called the Shari Shamayim Yeshiva. It was actually a yeshiva, they studied Kabbalah. Kabbalist yeshiva. And, you know, it was also, interestingly enough, if you look at the sign, the headquarters of the Palmach, of the sort of forerunner of the IDF that was responsible for defending this area. He was a member of the Palmach, that's a discussion we're going to have, right, Mr. Grant? And I have this image. This is not a scientific image, it's not a historically accurate image, but it's my image, right? In the same building, you've got these old rabbis with their white beards studying Kabbalah, and you've got these young, bronzed, you know, in their shorts, Palmach fighters, you know, defending the old city, right? And you kind of ask yourself a question, who was defending who? You know? But I told you that so that I can show you this. Come. So last stop, if you want to grab a seat, help yourself. This is an interesting place. I have to say, personally, of all the places in the old city, this absolutely is the place that gets me the most. You're sitting on the steps in front of the Rothschild building. This was actually the first apartment building that was built in the old city in the Jewish quarter for people without money. It was the first sort of public housing system in Israel back in the 1800s, 1860s. It was a free loan society. You came in, you got to live here for free for a year, but then you had to move out. It gave you a year to find your feet. If you look around you, you'll see that almost everything here is new, with the exception of these two buildings. This survived because this was actually the officers' quarters of the Jordanian Legion, and they had stables down below. And that survived because they had stables down underneath there. Okay? This courtyard, known as Bate Machzeh Square, okay, because it was because of this building, because it was a place of Bate Machzeh, it was a place where people could find refuge, the poor could come, they found free food, there was a soup kitchen here, 1800s. This was the place of the last stand of the Jewish quarter in 1948. And it's also the place where the Jewish people surrendered the old city of Jerusalem in 1948. May 25th, 1948. The Jewish people finally realized, the Jewish fighters, the civilians, they finally realized the jig was up. They were almost out of ammunition. They had very little food, very little supplies. the Jordanians had burst through, bombed the Khurva Square, found the generators and cut off electricity. They had no medical supplies. They were doing emergency operations in the middle of the night by flashlight with no morphine. They finally decided the jig was up and they got in touch with the Red Cross to arrange terms for surrender. The Jordanian Legion announced that they would accept terms for surrender on one condition, that the entire Jewish community had to gather in this square. Now you have to understand, this is 1948. This is 3 years after the Holocaust. Okay? Some of these people were Holocaust survivors, being told that they have to come to the Umstadtplatz, to the central square. So they came here, carrying their wounded, and they were surrounded by 3,000 legionnaires, and the rooftops were full of Arabs, mobs of Arabs. And to hear people who were here that day describe it, it's just an unbelievably frightening vision. Firing shots in the air, waving knives, rocks in their hands. Abdullah Tell, the commander of the Jordanian Legion, finally gets up, right, and basically calls for quiet and announces that, that he'll read terms for surrender. So everybody goes quiet, and he takes out a piece of paper. He says, terms for surrender, very simple. You have 1 hour. I and my men will not be responsible for any Jew that remains inside the old city of Jerusalem in 1 hour. And he sweeps his hand, and all the Arabs see this, and they start screaming and shooting their guns, whatever, tens of thousands. Now, imagine that you're here, it's a Friday afternoon, 2 weeks after the birth of the State of Israel on May 28th, and you have 1 hour. How long does it take with your old and your young and your sick and your wounded to walk out of the old city through the Zion Gate, down and up to Gen Zion Moshe? Takes an hour. So you basically leave from here. You can't take anything with you. The mobs are already destroying everything around them. They couldn't take anything with them, not their photographs, not their Jewish books, not their Torah scrolls, nothing. For some of these Jews, as the sun set, this was the first time in their lives that they'd ever desecrated Shabbat. And as the Arabs on the rooftop start to realize that, to their credit, the Jordanian Legion are protecting the Jews, because the Red Cross guarded ceasefire, and that they will not be able to take out their vengeance on Jewish lives, right? They begin to take out their frustration instead on Jewish buildings. Rav Getz, who would later become the rabbi of the Kotel, turns around and sees that the Tiferet Yisrael synagogue, which was over there, burst up into flames, throws himself to the ground in agony and screams out, Yimeshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right arm wither and my tongue cleave to my palate. And on an afternoon in May of 1948, 1,600 Jews leave the Jewish quarter in the smell of smoke and destruction, and for the next 19 years, the Jewish city of Yerushalayim, the old city of Yerushalayim, the Jewish quarter of Yerushalayim, is bereft of Jews. 19 years later, in the Six-Day War, we finally came home. And what we found here was beyond description. I have a friend who was one of the paratroopers who took the Kotel. He had played here as a boy, Yossi Weil. He told me he was in shock. He said men who called themselves secular had tears streaming down their faces when they saw it was here. But the Jewish people have never been about destruction. We've never been about looting. And so all we wanted to do, just like the story of Hanukkah, when all they wanted to do was to light a menorah, to bring light to the world, all we wanted to do was to rebuild. And that's what they did. And when they were rebuilding this quarter, somebody in his vision engraved a verse on the wall over there. You can see it. You can walk over afterwards, right? It's a verse from the end of the book of Zechariah. Zechariah the prophet witnessed the destruction of the temple, and amidst the flames of destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, calls out one final prophecy before the Jews are led into exile. Od yeshvuz kenimus kenot berchavot ha'ir, ishal mishan tome erov yamim. The old will yet sit in the alleyways of Jerusalem, leaning on their walking sticks for a length of days. For od mil ur chavotea, and the alleyways of Jerusalem will yet fill with the chounds of the children laughing. What you're looking at, this has become the playground of the Jewish quarter. And what you're looking at is the fulfillment of a 2,500-year-old prophecy, because the children have come back to play. It's interesting that Jewish people did not dream about the armies coming back in. We just dreamed that one day the children would come back to play. After 2,500 years, after 2,000 years of yearning and wandering, we've come home. Home. That word has such a magnificent sound to it, to a people that has wandered the face of the globe for so long. And I want to tell you that you may feel like you're a tourist and you've come to visit Yerushalayim, and on one level that's true. Home is where you hang your hat, whether it's in Texas or Alabama or New York. On another level, every Jew has another home. This is not my city. You're not coming to visit my city. This is our city. This is your city. And so I urge you, while you're here this week, explore her alleyways, fall in love with her stones, discover her stories and her magic, you know, and make this city your home. And God willing, one day soon, the sounds of peace will fill this land and this city. This week, and next week, and the week after, and forever until the end of time in Yerushalayim.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.